Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition, we're interviewing Tom Weidlinger, who directed the movie Jim Thorpe, The World's Greatest Athlete. He was the co-writer and co-producer of this movie as well. I spoke with Tom Weidlinger from his home in the San Francisco Bay Area on Sunday, May 30th, and began by asking him, who is Jim Thorpe? Tom Weidlinger, welcome to Radio Curious.
Good to be here.
So Jim Thorpe, the world's greatest athlete, can you tell us about him?
He was a Native American athlete that was born in the end of the 19th century, died in 1953, and was one of the most prominent Native Americans in sports in the first half of the 20th century. And was most famous for winning gold medals in both the decathlon and the pentathlon in the 1912 Stockholm Summer Games Olympic. And he was in a much publicized scandal a year later, stripped of those medals for having played semi-professional ball, was therefore considered a professional and was not eligible for the Olympics, a big scandal which we go into in the film.
And it was eventually resolved, but before we get to that, what drew your attention to Jim Thorpe?
Well, it was actually the man that I ended up working with, who was my co-writer and co-producer on the film, Joseph Bruschak, who is an Abenaki writer and storyteller. And I was interested in working with Joe, and it turned out that he had just finished a novel for young adults on Jim Thorpe, and I had never heard of Jim Thorpe until Joe introduced me to him. What interested both me and Joe was the fact that, surprisingly, there has been no serious documentary film about him as a Native American working his way through and contending with racial prejudice in the sports world. In the first half of the 20th century. So this was a story about Jim Thorpe as a sports hero, but also looking at his Native American background and how that kind of influenced his life and his choices and what happened to him.
Tell us about that background and the influence it did have on Jim Thorpe's life.
He was born in Oklahoma Territory in 1887. He was 5'8", Native American, predominantly of the Sac and Fox tribe, who are one of the many tribes that had been forcibly removed to Oklahoma Indian Territory in the 19th century. His father was a rancher, by the standards at that time, fairly well off. He was also a highly respected member of the Sac and Fox tribe, although he also had a reputation as kind of a wild man. Thorpe grew up in Oklahoma Territory and was brought up by his father. His father was very much an athlete, taught Jim to foot race and ride horses. His father felt very strongly that Jim needed to learn to read and write to kind of survive in the changing world. And he was sent to the agency Indian school, Sac and Fox School, that was 23 miles away from the ranch. Jim hated it and ran home, really resisted being in school.
You said he ran home, and in fact, he literally ran home at quite an astonishing rate.
Yes, he actually ran home. His father dropped him off at the Sac and Fox Agency Indian School, and he was out of there like a shot, and he basically ran cross-country and got home to his father's ranch before his father returned home with the horse and buggy. So that was one of the famous stories from Jim Thorpe's childhood, that he was already, by the age of six, quite a formidable runner. And after several attempts to kind of put him in various schools, each one further and further away from home, by the time he was a teenager, he he was sent to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which at that time was the most prominent of the federally funded Indian schools. There was this plan that if you could take Indian children out of their social and cultural context and completely isolate them in a kind of quasi military setting and teach them trades and teach them the basics of elementary and high school education, that they could then become quote-unquote useful citizens in the dominant culture. Although it sort of represented a progressive idea at the end of the 19th century, it was also pretty brutal. A lot of kids were just basically ripped away from their families and their cultures, and it was a kind of forced deracination.
Later on, at the Carlisle School, he and other Indian athletes were competitive with the white upper-class boys' schools in Pennsylvania and Middle Atlantic region, and ran into some fairly severe discrimination.
The blessing of Carlisle for Jim is that he was accepted into team sports, and he had a coach by the name of Pop Warner who kind of took Jim under his wing and trained him first in track, and then when Jim really persisted, accepted him on the football team. Carlisle really kind of gave Jim an identity as a sportsman, as well as the other sort of varsity boys lived a relatively pampered life at Carlisle in juxtaposition to the average students. And Pop Warner's sports program really brought the school fame nationally. And it was constantly being used and advertised as an example of how well this experiment of turning Indians into white men was working. Particularly the Indian football team did quite well against some of the big Eastern colleges. And when Jim was taken on the team, it really kind of took off. In terms of racism, was it any more vicious towards the Carlisle Indians? Not for the time. By today's standards, we would consider racist, but at that point in time, there was this kind of excitement about the Indians were coming to sort of play against the varsity boys, and there was all this sort of hype and lore about these sort of wild red Indians of the plains who had become football stars. And this was actually a drawing card, you know, a way to advertise the game. It sort of gave a sort of added frisson, you know, to the spectators to come and see the red men of the plain was one of the phrases that were used. So in our day and age, it is quite racist. I don't think it was any particularly racist or more racist than the way Indians were generally treated at that time in history. I'm not defending it, I'm just trying to give it a cultural context.
In terms of what was politically correct 100 years ago?
I don't think the idea of politically correct existed 100 years ago.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Tom Weidlinger, the director and co-writer and co-producer of a movie called Jim Thorpe, The World's Greatest Athlete. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Tom, in getting the movie together, what were your resources and the materials that became available to you?
Tracking down archive images was one of the most labor-intensive aspects of making the film. There are over 500 separate photographs in the film, and they hail from about 65 different archive sources, both nationally and internationally. And in addition to that, there's film footage from about 8 different film archives. So just the kind of logistics of finding stuff and negotiating for the rights to use it and digitally cleaning up old photographs that were in really bad shape was a huge undertaking. One of the most interesting sources were a huge collection of photographs from the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, which now reside with the Cumberland County Historical Society in Carlisle. What's interesting about this group of photographs is that because the school was sort of a social experiment, there was a very deliberate attempt to sort of document everything that was done at the school. So there are literally thousands of photographs of the students over a period of about 40 years. And Jim Thorpe, particularly after he became a prominent football player there, figures prominently in the photographic record. So the fact that there was this very dense cache of material from an early period in Jim Thorpe's life really, you know, gave us some good stuff to work with in a documentary film. The one caveat was that the photographs were all taken to make Carlisle look good. So they don't really, unless you kind of look really deeply into the images and sort of look at the expressions of faces, you don't kind of sense the darker side of what was going on there. And we impart that through commentary and also interviews with other people.
Well, I don't want you to give away the full aspect of the movie, Jim Thorpe, the World's Greatest Athlete, but tell us about some of that darker side.
The film in itself, I don't think, is a dark film. I think it's fairly balanced. What we kind of worked against was all of Jim Thorpe's biographers, I think, took a fairly sort of interpreted his life in a fairly simplistic way, which is to say, here was this poor Indian boy who came from, you know, a poverty-stricken Indian reservation in Oklahoma, was taken under the wing of a great football coach at Carlisle, you know, had this meteoric career which you know, took him to the Olympics, and then it crashed in 1913 when he was accused of playing semi-pro baseball, and end of story. And in fact, his not only the events before that time were much more complex, but also he went on to have quite an interesting life in professional football and professional baseball and football. And then later on, as an actor and organizer of Indian actors in Hollywood. The most of the biographies just kind of deal with this sort of meteoric kind of rise and fall of a character, which is kind of very two-dimensional. I think that we really went further than that, so you get a sense more of the rounded individual.
There was the crash that you speak of in 1913, where it was alleged that he played professional ball. But that was recouped. That was changed later on.
It was changed posthumously. Basically what happened was, do you want me to go into the whole detail of what happened at this point? Or?
Sure.
It was very common in this time period for college athletes, and particularly Indian kids at Carlisle who didn't really have any income, when they had their summers, to play semi-professional baseball as a way of making a little pocket money and basically staying in shape. And the coaches knew about this. Pop Warner knew about it. They basically kind of looked the other way. For a lot of kids, played under assumed names so that they would not kind of jeopardize their academic standing. When Jim went to South Carolina to play baseball in 1909, he had been at Carlisle for 2 years, and he had no intention of going back. So he actually played semi-pro baseball in North Carolina for a couple of years. During these 2 years, the football team in Carlisle did very badly. And basically, Jim's coach, Pop Warner, asked Jim if he would come back to Carlisle to play on the football team because he really needed him. So Jim accepted Pop's invitation, never really realizing that having played summer ball was a problem and having given his own name. And in 1911 and 1912 really led the Carlisle team to major gridiron triumphs. So Jim had really spent two periods at Carlisle, and the second one was where he became very famous, and he came back to Carlisle because the football coach, with the full knowledge that he'd been playing amateur baseball, asked him to come back so he would make the team look good and make the coach look good. To Jim, the idea of making $25 a week playing summer ball, it kind of didn't fit into his consciousness that this was a betrayal of the amateur sports ethic. And he just went along and did what Pop asked him to do, and Pop sent him to the Olympics, again, fully aware of Jim's semi-pro baseball days. And then when the news broke in 1913, Pop denied any knowledge of this, because if he had acknowledged that he'd known that Jim had played semi-pro ball, it would have really jeopardized his career as a football coach. So basically, Pop wrote a letter of confession for Jim to sign, and Jim signed it, and basically kept Pop and Carlisle, basically kept their noses clean, so there were no repercussions against the school.
So he became the fall guy.
Yeah, the goat.
yes. But that was changed posthumously after Jim Thorpe died.
Well, it was a long, long battle. A key figure within the International Olympic Committee was Avery Bundage, who was upper-class kid from the Midwest who was also at the Olympics in 1912 with Jim. And Jim roundly outperformed Avery Bundage in several Olympic categories. And Bundage saw to it that despite pleas from many sources that Jim's gold medal be restored, that they were not, as long as he had a voice within the International Olympic Committee. And it was only after he retired from the scene that the family, with the help of various political figures, was able to lobby for a return of these medals.
In your personal experience, are you a sports fan?
Not at all. No. I really this was quite an education for me, and it was fascinating to work with a co-writer who was very knowledgeable about sports, and to just kind of to learn about that.
So the story, if you were to describe a moral to the story that is told, or a specific theme to the story that is told in Jim Thorpe, the world's greatest athlete, what would that be?
Oh, God, I hate that question. And the reason why I hate it is that I don't want people who watch my films, I don't want to tell them what they should think and what they should derive from it.
Well, maybe I can ask it this way. What did you derive from it?
I think what I derived from it is that, to me, what's interesting is it's the first film that I've made. I made a lot of films, but the first film that's been a biography about a famous historical character. In making the film, which took a long time, over 3.5 years, is we consulted many sources, we've read many books, we talked to many people, and how the account of Jim Thorpe's life changes over time, and the way he was seen in his own day, the way he was seen in retrospect, and how the perspective on a historical figure is often distorted, might be too strong a word, but sort of characterized by what the particular social or cultural or political viewpoint is at a point in time. So, which made it challenging because there's a lot of mythology around the character of Jim Thorpe, some of it even believed by his own family. And so to separate facts from mythology and to do the man justice was a very interesting and delicate process. And I found that exhilarating, and I guess that's what I got out of it.
Well, Tom Weidlinger, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, now that you've completed this movie and several others, What would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
Well, I hope to continue making films that have something hopeful to say about the human condition. I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm more interested in finding stories that, you know, may be difficult or painful, but where there is some element of persistence or hope or understanding that sort of comes out of it. Then I guess the second thing is not only getting to make those films, but to find a meaningful life for the film after it's made, which doesn't necessarily only mean public television broadcast, but where it becomes useful in some context, whether it's education or advocacy.
And in your life experience, is there a particular eureka or aha moment that you could share with us?
There was certainly a kind of turning point in my life as a filmmaker, and that was the year that I turned 50, which was already 7 years ago. I went to make a film in Congo at the end of the Civil War there about humanitarian aid. And I had never made a film under such difficult conditions and surrounded by just a lot of death and suffering, basically. And I think that kind of focused my sense of what was, you know, how I wanted to spend my time for the rest of my life. And it's not that I suddenly, you know, wanted to start saving the world. It's just that in some kind of inexplicable way, it kind of made choices clearer. And that was a sort of painful but salutary experience.
And finally, Tom Weidlinger, is there a book that you could tell us about that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, we have a little neighborhood book group where I live, and we read novels, a lot of contemporary fiction, and we just finished reading a book called Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese, V-E-R-G-H-E-S-E, and it's a story that is mostly set in Ethiopia starting in the 1950s during the reign of Haile Selassie. It's about two boys who are born in a missionary hospital and grow up in Addis Ababa and themselves become doctors, and they themselves are the children of expatriates. And I just thought that the portrayal of time and place, Ethiopia in the 1950s, was not something I knew a lot about, and there was a very compelling image and feeling for that time. And also a novel which weaves together the influences on a personal level of different cultures. I mean, there's British, Hindu, Ethiopian, and American principal characters in the film, and it sort of deals very interestingly with cross-cultural tensions. So I liked it a lot. I heartily recommend it.
Well, Tom Weidlinger, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Tom Weidlinger is the director and co-producer and co-writer of the movie Jim Thorpe, The World's Greatest Athlete. This interview was recorded on May 30th, 2010. The book that Tom Weidlinger recommends is Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast at www.radiocurious.podomatic.com. and you will be regularly notified as each one of our new programs are put on the web and available to you. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. Our programs are recorded in our studios in Ukiah, California. Hannah Bird heads our post-production staff. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.